So we actually have, for example, a study where people go on a real museum tour, and some people take photos and some people don't. And the ones who take photos, they remember more of the visual artifacts and the details of the museum, but they remember less of the things that the tour guide told them or said.
You are listening to one of my favorite podcasts,
The Brain and Brand Show, where you'll hear science and inspiration from guests like neuroscientist Dr. Tara Swart.
Welcome to The Brain and Brand Show. I'm Timothy Maurice. Thanks so much for choosing this episode. It means so much to me. In my quest to understand how our brains influence your personal and organization success, when it comes to storytelling, personal branding, and the value of your products and brands, I came across the research of Alexandria Barash. I want you to listen to our conversation closely and consider the sheer power and potential of what you can do with your phone, but more importantly, how you can influence the people you work with, your kids and others around you, and what her research says about what it does to your brain. You're going to find this really enlightening and completely fascinating. Alexandra is a New York University Stern Professor of Marketing. Enjoy.
Alexandra Barish, welcome to the Brain and Brand Show.
Thank you.
Are you in New York right now?
For this year, I'm doing a visiting stay at another university at INSEAD. So it's based outside Paris in Fontainebleau. I split my time between New York and France.
So the time difference is not so stark.
I was going to say, when I noticed where you were calling from, I was actually like, huh, we had a range of times we could have played with, for sure.
You've done research all over the world. I saw where you've researched in Asia, mainland Asia, and Hong Kong, and you did your undergraduate work in North Carolina. Tell us a little bit about what got you into this sort of research interest, and how these regions of the world is impacted your thinking about it.
Yeah, that's a great start. So like you said, I got my undergraduate at Duke, North Carolina. And during that time, as you're kind of exploring for any liberal arts education, I found the field of psychology to be immensely fascinating. And I took a lot of classes in psych, and I started realizing that there was this cool world outside of the more applied counseling side, sides of psychology, that you could actually do cutting edge research that actually uncovers new information about consumers and about humans and the way they make decisions. After graduating, went to New York and did education policy research for a couple of years. But then I started really learning about the field of behavioral economics, and that took me towards the field of marketing, which is where most kind of behavioral economics research is based in the university system. I went to do a Fulbright scholarship in Hong Kong and Macau, where I got a chance to explore kind of more specific research topics. And you asked about the connection to, you know, how does like the studying these things in different cultures affect my work? And it was really there in Hong Kong that I got this really cool chance to see how the East and the West and the merging of cultures with the British influence. And then I started grad school, and I went to Philadelphia for that, University of Pennsylvania. And so, yeah, the international exposure has influenced my research quite a bit.
You know, doing your undergrad at Duke, right across campus, I'm sure, was Dan O'Reilly.
Yeah,
at the business school. Have you guys had a chance to meet each other?
Yeah, he was a key for getting me into the field. Dan O'Reilly actually arrived right, I think I was a sophomore at the time. And I went to one of his big keynote speeches, like, you know, this new amazing professor from MIT is here, and we're going to, you know, hear from him. And I was like, literally just watching his presentation was like, now I know this is what I want to do. And he got me into research. He connected me with people. He was connecting me with people during my time in New York, right after undergrad. And then those individuals were kind of instrumental to getting me into, you know, into PhD programs. So Dan Ariely, I credit him a lot to being here and having the chance to work on such cool stuff. And he's obviously the king of working on cool stuff. So yeah, he is amazing.
Let's kind of take a step back a little bit. I mean, I get so excited about this type of work and behavioral economics and behavioral psychology that I jump ahead. For anyone listening to this who's not familiar with your work and they just kind of generally want to know, what do you say you do when you meet someone at a bar or just randomly?
In general, I would say my research is studying how new technologies reshape the way that consumers are experiencing their lives. So this comes from their enjoyment and immersion in experiences. It comes from their memories of their experiences. And it also comes in their communication and their social connection with other individuals. So new technology can be a number of different types of behaviors, of ranging from photo taking, content creation, live streaming, social media usage. All of these things, I'm just interested in how these new forums and these new technologies are shifting the way that we experience the world.
So if we go back through our evolutionary background and we look at our ancestors, would their tools in terms of being able to carve something in a rock be very similar in terms of us posting now?
That is interesting. So yeah, to the extent that carving into rocks is about documenting, it's about communicating. Probably those two dimensions are the, I'd say, the key. If you ask people, why do you take photos? Why do you create content? It's either for your personal goals, so to document or remember something, or it's to share and communicate with others. And so to the extent that these are kind of the basic, like, private versus public trade-offs, you know, these cavemen were thinking about their cave carvings probably very similarly.
Staying at that point, we go back through our evolutionary background and we fast forward to today. Would our ancestors have been as eager to communicate? Are our instincts, because we're so social, is the technology really just enabling us to do what we already wired to do? Right. Or are we evolving and shifting?
That is really interesting. You know, the number of people can observe our content is just on a level that, you know, our ancestors would have no, they wouldn't even make sense to them, is probably changing the way that we're going through our experiences. It's changing the approach that we take and how much we want to document and share. And yeah, it might be amplifying the social, you know, tendencies that we already had. It's at least making them more salient all the time, because it's like it's feeling more and more like you're never quite alone. Everything can be recorded and shared at any time. So that's a really interesting point. I can see that shifting for sure.
Yesterday, I went to our local Starbucks in South Africa has only had Starbucks for a couple of years. So there's still a lot of cachet around posting your Starbucks coffee.
Right.
But as I was writing yesterday, I looked up and I saw this young woman. She walked in and she was really dressed to post. Mm-hmm. She had this Gucci headband on. She was really dolled up. And she orders some sort of frappuccino and a chocolate chip cookie. She grabs her chocolate chip cookie. She goes outside in front of the Starbucks sign. Uh-huh. And she finally finds someone who can do the photo shoot.
Right.
And she takes the cookie and she puts it close to her mouth. This photo shoot begins to happen. She grabs this older person and she directs them around and so forth. And what was fascinating was after the photo shoot, she throws away the cookie and the frappuccino. She never intended to actually have it.
Yep.
And in that moment, I was thinking, this is just sheer raw content. Perhaps the ability to create that content created a pleasure that the actual Frappuccino wouldn't have been able to create for her. Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm interested in your work. So let's go into your paper.
Okay. Yeah.
So let's talk about how generating content increases enjoyment.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's great. I love your story and how it relates to the paper. So first of all, yeah, that we were really interested in whether and how content generation, which by that we just mean the kind of creation of any text or photos, generating content about a relevant experience as you're going through it, which is really key because, you know, so much content we can create after the fact, but we were interested in how does, in the moment of doing this content creation, how does that change your experience? How does it change the way that you, the details that you notice in the experience? How does it change your feelings of immersion or engagement? And then subsequently, how does that affect your enjoyment of the moment? And so, like you kind of pointed out in your story, there's, you know, just this raw behavior that we were doing all the time. Technology has enabled it. We have our smartphones in our pockets all the time. We're always able to text or write on social media or take a note for ourselves in a way that we just wouldn't have done, you know, a decade or two decades ago. Given that so many people talk about, you know, the negatives of these things, the media loves to, you know, tell you got to put your phone away or you're ruining your life. You know, we hear that from our family. There's certainly times where that is, you know, disruptive. But we couldn't help but ignore just the quantity of data that was being created. And we're like, there must be something that's actually benefiting consumers or people in these contexts. And so we set out to study it. The general takeaway across dozens of studies that we've run is that this behavior can actually be quite immersive. So, to your point, again, this Frappuccino and chocolate chip cookie wasn't the end. The end goal of her experience. It was about generating content. It was about taking photos, probably posting and sharing something. My research would suggest that could potentially be an enjoyable thing for her. I mean, of course, there's some other dimensions that come into play, and we can talk about that too. And the self-presentational concern that comes with anxiety and all these things about, you know, getting enough likes and shares and comments, those things also play a role. But in terms of like just boiling it down to the behavior itself, there's a lot of our work that would suggest that can be an enjoyable experience.
Yeah, I have two people in mind with this conversation. Yeah. One is the content creator, but also the marketers and brands who are interested in your research. So let's say you are Red Bull and you have a massive event that you have organized and it's next to a basketball court and you bring all these people out. Are you basically saying that if Red Bull sets up an experience and they get people there to create content, that the immersion of that creation, you create additional value? Can you unpack that a little bit for Red Bull?
Yeah, you summarized it great. But just to kind of unpack it, I would say there's kind of different components that Red Bull would want to think about. So there is, of course, the content creation itself as a source of value for companies, for brands, because for them, having people post and share is a metric that they care about. So I'm actually putting that aside in my research because of course, brands would like for people to be talking about them and, you know, either positive or negative. Oftentimes we say all of these conversations are good for brands, but separate from that, how does the behavior or action of the content creation itself influence those people's experience of the event? People are creating the content. If Red Bull can encourage content creation, let's say through an incentive program, rewarding consumers, giving them raffles for the content creation. Maybe they can do it through hashtags and other types of engagement tools to get people to want to post and to share. Maybe they can do it through normative messaging. So telling people that It's really common. We actually expect a lot of people to share. That increases behavior. So regardless of what their tool is for encouraging it, if they get their consumers to actually create more content, our research would suggest that that itself can actually be immersive. And the reason is because you have to search the event for things to comment on. So whenever I'm just watching something, my mind can wander. I might be thinking of something irrelevant to the experience, but there's something really powerful about creating content that forces your attention onto the event. It makes you perceive things you might not have otherwise seen. And you might hear new sounds, you might notice new details. And that process is really powerful for immersing or engaging people in the moment. And it's something that usually people can kind of relate to once they think about the difference between relevant content creation and irrelevant content creation. So if I was Red Bull and I was asking you to post about something totally random and not relevant to the event, your mind would be elsewhere. But if I'm looking at the, you know, motorcycle drivers or the whatever the event is, there's some skydivers or something, that's actually getting me to be more engaged. And that's something that we find across dozens of experiences, from safari tours to watching TV, that people, when they are noticing these kind of these extra details, and it's a relatively positive experience, that it increases their enjoyment. And I would expect Red Bull to care a lot about how consumers enjoy the moment, in addition to kind of their memories, and that and enjoyment, of course, translates into long-term effects as well. People talk about things and share. And those are also metrics that Red Bull cares about.
You did a lot of your research both in the lab and outside the lab. Can you talk a little bit about how you structured your research to get this data?
Yep. So yeah, that's really important to us. We use field studies to kind of get data with kind of higher ecological or external validity. Sometimes this data is more correlational in nature, so we're not actually looking at experiments there. We're just observing. Sometimes we're just collecting data from Twitter, what people are talking about. Sometimes we're surveying people in the field, but we always want to, with a research question like this, like, you have to go out there and get real world experiential data. It's just not enough to just look in the laboratory. But at the same time, it's not enough to just look in the field, because when you're in the kind of messy real world, it's hard to isolate the effect that you're looking at. We're really interested in causal data that suggests that when I create content, when I do X, Y will happen. So when I create content, enjoyment will increase. So in the lab, we can get a lot more control. But it's really important to have both. And all of my work in this area always has a mixture of both lab and field studies for that reason.
Were there any findings that surprised you?
Ooh, that's a good one. I mean, to be honest, going into the original like body of work, which really started back in grad school, I came in, you know, influenced by the media and the intuitions that we talked about earlier. So maybe if I'm taking all of these pictures, it's coming in between me and the experience. You know, there's like a physical barrier, and I'm potentially, if I'm taking so many pictures, it's crowding out my ability to enjoy the moment. And so I would say that my collaborators and I definitely had, you know, mixed opinions about our first set of data, because it was kind of hard to accept at first. There was a lot of kind of push to like find data that would, you know, be consistent with all of these kind of negative intuitions. But in the end, you kind of also have to listen to what your data says. And at some point, after so many studies showing that photo taking or content creation, it increases the kind of engagement and immersion and enjoyment of experiences. And also in this new paper, we look at time perception. So, how how quickly time seems to pass. Like when you're doing these behaviors, like time speeds up. It makes you feel kind of, extra immersed into the moment. And so you, as a result, like you kind of lose track of time. We call that a flow state. And so there were all of these kind of effects that we, at some point we had to accept what the data was showing us. But I would say that at first we were surprised for sure.
I'm imagining you, are you speaking at a conference hosted by Sam Harris and a bunch of mindfulness experts?
right. Man, I wonder what they think of our data. Yeah.
But let's get to the crux of what the data dispels. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I'm even guilty of speaking to my niece by saying, yeah, you're missing the moment, you're not present, etc. What does the data specifically dispel?
Yeah, I'd say that I think it helps to actually see the distinction between when it helps and when it hurts as a way to help figure out what it dispels. So there's a lot of work suggesting that when we get on our phones, it can become a disruptive part of the experience. So there's a cognitive element to that. So I'm paying attention to the phone instead of maybe our conversation. And there's a social component to that. So how do you feel if I'm on my phone? It's definitely not, it can be distracting. It can make you feel like I'm not fully engaged or immersed in our conversation or the moment. You know, so much of this previous work actually has really focused on when people are on their phones engaging in tasks that are conflicting with the goals of the moment. They're conflicting with the fact that we're having a social interaction. They're conflicting. It's like I'm multitasking. I'm trying to do something else with my phone, and that takes me out of the moment. So that's very fair. There's a lot of data that suggests that can be harmful. What I think our research comes in and points out and is really, really important is that so much of the content creation that we engage in is actually very relevant to the moment. We're commenting or reacting or sharing with somebody who isn't there, or, you know, even talking to somebody next to us who is there. And there's so much of these behaviors that we do that are actually not in direct conflict with the moment. And those are the types of content creation behaviors that I would encourage. The types of photo taking is oftentimes very relevant to the moment because you can't take photos of something that's not in front of you. And so that's where the research actually started. And now even with the, you know, content, the phone is distracting. Yes, it can be for sure. But what our data dispels is that it's always distracting, that there's no way you can use the phone or these tools, these new technological tools in a way that enhances the moment. It just depends on the way that you do it.
I mean, this is an important part of the conversation because whatever's happening in the moment and the goals of all the stakeholders and all the parties involved need to be aligned, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And yes, sometimes the consumer's goals are different from, say, the company's goals. But in general, companies would like it if consumers enjoyed their moments more. And yes, sometimes there's two consumers involved and one wants to focus on the experience and one wants to be distracted with their cell phone. And that's a conflict, too. But in general, like we're all pretty much looking towards greater enjoyment and experiential consumption. How can we enhance those things?
I want you to comment on a couple scenarios. The first scenario, I remember being at a Jay-Z concert in New York, actually. And I saw the branding around and people were videoing and they were, you know, posting while he was performing. And I thought to myself, the brands are really benefiting from this, but he's not. And as I was thinking that, he says, could you please put your phones away and enjoy the concert?
What
would you say in that moment? Because that's a classic case of misalignment.
Yeah, different stakeholders, right. So the brands are certainly benefiting from that and they are studying that immensely and how exactly, like how to quantify the extra engagement that they get from those behaviors. But from the perspective of the artist, I think that's a really good point. I I do feel conflicted about that, because there's some parts of the consumer experience that can become better from creating content, from taking photos. But there are trade-offs, and actually in the earlier photo taking work, we show a direct trade-off between how photos enhance your memory for visual details, and they engage you kind of in, of course, the perceptual details that you're noticing in your visual field. But there's a direct trade-off with anything auditory. So we actually have, for example, a study where people go on a real museum tour. And some people take photos and some people don't. And the ones who take photos, they remember more of the visual artifacts and the details of the museum, but they remember less of the things that the tour guide told them or said. And so to the extent that a Jay-Z concert or any concert really is largely an auditory experience, so because we're trying to listen to music and lyrics, then Jay-Z really had a good point. Putting down the devices would mean that you'd be more attuned to the auditory details of that experience. He might be missing or forgetting some of the other benefits, of course, because he's thinking about his music. But I can see that sort of trade-off and where artists and musicians would actually prefer that people put away their devices. And I think that's interesting and also fair.
Okay, the second scenario, when I'm home for Thanksgiving and my parents and my niece are at loggerheads about what to do with this phone, would you suggest to my parents to get my niece to post about the food? And maybe that could immerse her in the moment.
Totally. That's so fun. Maybe that's like a good trade-off or a good compromise, I would say. Niece, I'm guessing, is younger, so she probably doesn't like to give up her device. But the way that you're using that device really matters. So post about the food, tell your friends about what we're doing here. I guarantee that if she uses the phone in that way, instead of, her side conversations, that she would actually end up wanting to put the phone down, because she would be becoming more immersed and engaged in some moment that she's talking about.
All right, let's talk a little bit about what's happening in the brain when it comes to in the content creation experience.
So we, in the earlier work, we do have eye tracking data, and I think that's our closest insight into what is, I would say, the mechanism behind these effects. And so what we find in this earlier work is that when people are, for example, taking photos, but content creation would fit into the same category. When people are doing these content creation behaviors, they're becoming more honed in on details relevant to the experience. So they're less likely to look around or see other irrelevant things that don't have to do with the moment. When you're forcing people's attention, essentially, it's a very attentional and perceptual mechanism. When you're forcing people to notice things about their surroundings, they're able to kind of put some of those other aspects, the mind wandering side of their psyche, out of their mind. And so that's where we see all of the positive effects of immersion coming from. It's interesting that you mentioned kind of the mindfulness people, because we actually, at the end of our paper, talk about how, mindfulness is always about being present. And while, of course, like a side behavior feels like it might not be relevant, we're suggesting that the content creation is actually very much focusing your mind on the moment. It's causing you to actually shift your attention to the relevant details. And so in that sense, the brain is more sharp and focused and thinking about the moment, instead of all the millions of things that we have on our mind and why we can't sleep at night.
Any thoughts around as the world continues to turn the page from this COVID-19 moment and the effects of technological disruption create a bit of a hybrid event style where many events will go back to being in person, but a lot will be online.
Yeah.
Any thoughts around how to keep people's attention and how to create, right. You know, if I'm in a conference, yeah. Is there a way to get people more immersed in the experience?
Love it. Yeah, that's a great thing to think about. So first of all, so many of our studies, because they happen in the lab, we actually have a real kind of content creation happening in these virtual environments, which seemed like it could have potentially been a weakness of our research, you know, maybe a year ago, but is now very much the way that we're going through experiences. We go to the zoo virtually, we're doing so many things online. And so here we actually have like real, software that allows people to create content on the screen. So I'm watching an experience, but I'm also typing about it. And maybe I have different ways to ask you to do that. But in general, these hybrid events that you're referring to, I think could very much benefit from building in content creation into their platforms. Maybe it is with sharing with other consumers, but I would say even just like give people a spot to take notes. I mean, we're never really connecting people in our studies because we don't want to add the noise. We're just getting people to write about the moment, and it is super consistent in how much it increases their enjoyment. So that could be one takeaway in terms of these kind of future events that are going to be created. I mean, conferences is another great example you mentioned. It's, you don't want to be rude to speakers, of course, and make them feel like you're not listening. But so much of the time when I'm on my phone, I'm taking notes. And that's actually means that I'm more engaged and thinking about what they're saying. So it's something we've actually talked to conference organizers and event creators before COVID about how you might build into these like conference platforms and apps and stuff, how to get people to engage more. So it might be that our research is very timely for the COVID environment, that this might be the perfect time to kind of embrace and adopt these things. And realizing that the devices are not going away, and we can, as long as we can get people to use them in an enhancing way instead of a distracting way, it would benefit everybody.
What are your thoughts about the future of the ability to immerse yourself with technology?
Huh? Yeah, that's interesting. So, augmented reality. That's what I'm thinking.
Yes.
So yeah, that's a great future direction for this work and for, yeah, thinking about how these things will influence these experiences moving forward, because so much of what's being developed, it's not just about total virtual reality. I'm in a world that I, is totally made up or is fantasy. It's about enhancing the experience that you're in. It's about noticing new details. And, as I walk down the street, I can actually sort of observe my surroundings more closely. So much of the new technologies, whether it's like just looking through my phone at the real world or with the glasses, so much of that is really about just kind of enhancing the way that we live our lives.
I think as we move towards a close, let's come up with a few tips based on the data that brands should be thinking about. Let's see if we can come up with three interesting, you've already given us a lot, so thank you so much. Mm-hmm. But any other insights? Can we come up with three that brands should be thinking about to maximize on the immersive potential of content creation?
Yeah. So one thing we didn't talk about yet that is in another paper, but is, I think, quite relevant for brands to think about is how to get people to create the content in the moment, but save the anxiety provoking parts of content creation for later. So it's going to be hard if you're sharing data to get people to just not care about any of the social elements, because that's just our human nature to care about what other people think about us. So given that that's part of, any sharing, how can I as a brand think about a way to get all of the positives from the content creation in the moment and leave some of the sharing parts that create self-presentational concern how can I shift that to being part of the actor experience? And so I really think that's like a good way to kind of conceptualize it. So first of all, if you're a brand, you want to think about what your goal is. If your goal is visual, get people to take photos. If it's auditory, and you're, an artist or a musician, maybe you want to get people to put their phones away and record, because that actually will enhance their auditory experience. So you want to first start with your goal as like a marketer, as a brand. And then once you decide kind of what behavior in the moment benefits consumers, and you get them to capture the content, you want to sort of figure out a way to divide up the content creation from the sharing. And so when I'm sharing, I'm thinking about, oh, is this going to get enough likes, and who's going to comment on my photo? Those are things that we want to leave for after the experience. We don't want people to be thinking about these salient sharing goals in the moment. So I really encourage brands to keep that as much as possible separate. Maybe encourage content creation through normative messaging or incentives, but the hashtags can be shared after the fact. It's of course something that will encourage sharing and posting, but to the extent that Wi-Fi or connectivity is limited during the moment, it could actually get people to really focus on, of course, capturing it, because you want to document, and that's all about the content creation. And then afterwards, you go home and you post it and you share it and you get all the benefits from that as well. But it's a little bit more divided. So I would say those are maybe kind of three segments or tips to think about: the pre-goals, think about the moment and how to encourage the behavior, but then leave the self-presentational part for afterwards.
Finally, let's look quickly at the content creator themselves. Let's empower them a little bit.
Uh-huh.
They're being judged. I sit here at the beginning of this conversation and I judged kind of this Starbucks content creator on some level. Maybe I didn't really judge her, but on some level, maybe I was when I was sitting there. How do we empower them? And what are they doing that is interesting? Based on your research, their need to signal, their signaling to the world.
Yeah.
What's interesting about them that they can actually leverage and share with either potential brands they want to partner with or their family members who are judging them?
That's super interesting. I would point to some basic psychology research that is really focused on kind of two dimensions of what we do when we're sharing. So one is just a general desire to make a positive impression with people. So we want to actually, I would like you to like me. I would like you to avoid disliking me. So there's kind of the approach and the avoidance that we do just all the time. And then there's also the part of self-presentation that comes with curating our identities. And so this might be the part that I would point to content creators to realize that so much of what they're doing and communicating is not, it's not just a look at me, think highly of me, which I think is very natural and makes sense also. But to the extent that you're telling people about who you are and kind of what your brand is as a content creator, what is your identity? I mean, these are really basic things that have been studied so long in psychology. How do we share our identities? Is it, it's coming from the brands that we use. It's coming from our communication. And so when we're creating content, all we're trying to do is to tell people a little bit more about who we are and bond over the ways that you're similar. Then that could be a way to really think about those behaviors in a more positive light and to see, some empowerment in the way that influencers, content creators, all these people are actually, connecting people in a way that that those who are more private and don't create content are not. So I like that.
Which side of the spectrum are you? Has this research changed how you post and create content?
It's hard for me to post at this point without thinking about all the millions of things I'm communicating. I don't think that's a bad thing for people whose brand is centered around that. But for me as a researcher, I like to be a little more introspective. And so that's something that I've kind of moved towards with time. We'll see what happens in the future, though.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us on the Brain and Brand Show.
Nice to talk with you. It was a blast.
A huge thanks to Professor Barish, who I hope becomes a regular contributor to the show. She's refreshing, and her ongoing research linking behavior and technology will always be welcomed. Please share your thoughts in the comments section or email me, podcast@timothymaurice.com. And please rate us. The platform will promote us more as the number of ratings go up. Until next time.